You no doubt have heard the expression in life that says something like this: you've got to play the hand that you're dealt. You got to play the hand that you're dealt. And we mean by that, when we hear it or when we say it, that, you know, hey, there are things you have no control over, circumstances that you didn't create, and you've just got to live with it. You've got to do the best you can with the hand that you're dealt. Well, there are a few things in all of our lives that comprise that hand, so to speak, that we were dealt. Not one of us here had any say-so in who our parents were going to be. We weren't consulted in that. We had no choice. We had no input. Not one of us here had any say-so as far as where we were going to be born. That was dictated to us. Not one of us had any input whatsoever as to what the color of our hair was going to be, how tall we were going to be, how short we were going to be, whether we were going to be lean or stocky. All of that was decided for us. And there's one other thing that none of you had any input whatsoever. And we might not consider that to be as important as some of the others, but I would like to challenge that notion and say that it is extremely important. Not one of you this morning had the privilege of choosing your name. Someone else did that for you. Or maybe someone else did that to you. You had no choice in that. Well, you say it's just a name. Well, the name you now possess, the one you've had all of your lives, that title by which every person you know has addressed you, was given to you by somebody else. When I was about to be born, I'm told that there was some debate as to what my name was going to be. The family had gathered together and names had been tossed about, and I was told that I came within a whisker or two of being named Jerome. Had I been named Jerome, I would have been addressed probably as Jerry or someone for the rest of my life. I say almost was I named Jerome. Obviously, I wasn't. I'm told at the last moment, my oldest uncle on my mother's side, her oldest brother, came up with the name Bruce, and my mother grabbed it. I don't know whether or not it was a way to settle the dispute or not, but she grabbed hold of that and said, that's what it's going to be, and the rest of my life has been what it is. I have wondered many times, would it have made any difference if I had been named Jerome rather than Bruce? Would it have made any difference? I mean, it's just a word. It's just a name. Actually, studies have been presented that indicate that your name does have an impact as to how the rest of your life will go. That seems strange. That seems strange, but nonetheless, if the studies are true in any way, shape, or form, my life may have been quite different if I had been named Jerome rather than Bruce. Well, I go back to the idea that no one gets to choose their names. It's given to you by someone else, and the giving of a name certainly is one of the most intimate activities that you will ever engage in, because someone gave you your name, but if you're a parent, you probably gave someone else their name, right? That was a pretty important event. If you remember that first child or the second or the third trying to determine what that name was going to be. I remember when Emily was born, trying to determine what her name was going to be. And, of course, everybody had an input, Carla and then my son Stuart, and what's it going to be? And I threw a name out. No, I know somebody who has that name, and I don't like them. cross it off the list. And so it went back and forth and back and forth. Well, how is that going to sound? You know, we got to have another. I was a big thing for, you know, we got to have a, because of my last name, we've got to have a middle name that's got at least three syllables. Otherwise, it'll sound like Morse code, dot, dot, dot. I've always felt that that was my name, Bruce Dean Hain. Not very melodic. Well, anyway, we finally decided on Emily. We spent a great deal of time, a great deal of thought in selecting names for our children. Others, however, seem to pick them at random. Sometimes their names are chosen after an ancestor, grandfather, grandmother, what it might be. I thought it might be interesting to see what names were selected for children in America over the last 100 years. I looked at the records in the Social Security Administration that they had compiled, and here are some of the most popular names that were given by babies in order of the decade. We're going to go all the way back to 1900. Between 1900 and 1910, here's what the four most popular boys' names were and the four most popular girls' names. 1900, you either had John, William, James, or George, or Mary, Helen, Anna, or Margaret. 1910 to 1920, John, William, James, Robert, or Mary, Helen, Margaret, and along came Dorothy. 1920 to 1930, Robert, James, John, or William. Mary, Betty, Dorothy, Helen. Let's move ahead, 1940 to 1950. James, Robert, John, William. Those boys' names are holding pretty steady there. The girls, they seem to change a little bit more often. Mary, Barbara, oh, here comes Patricia, and Carol. 1950 to 1960. John, James, Robert, and William. Not much imagination there. But for girls, we got Linda, Mary, Patricia, and now comes Barbara. 1960, David, Michael, John, and James. So David enters the picture. For girls, Mary, Susan, Maria, and Karen. A little bit of evolution going on there. 1970, Michael, David, John, James. Girls, Jennifer, Lisa, Kimberly, and Michelle. That seems to be a real shift there. We decided we were going to get out of the rut, apparently. 1980, Michael, Jason, Christopher, and David. Girls, still Jennifer, but we've added Jessica, now Amanda and Melissa. In 1990, it was Michael, Christopher, Joshua, and Matthew, while girls were Jessica, Ashley, Brittany, and Amanda. And since 2000, it's been Jacob, Michael, Matthew, and Joshua. And girls, Emily, Hannah, Madison, and Ashley. I thought that was kind of interesting. What is in a name? In ancient times, names were given, they were descriptive of events, such as when Isaac dug a well and he named it Sheba, meaning oath. You remember the dispute about the wells? He and Abimelech's servants had been quarreling about water rights, and then they gave oaths to each other, and they named that well Sheba. It was near the town of Beersheba, which meant oath well. Earlier, he had dug another well, and he named it Esek, which means quarrel. I think most of us are familiar, then, with the idea that names in the ancient world, of which the Bible was a part, were often descriptive of either events or character traits, personalities, and nowhere do we find that more vividly in Scripture than in the life of Jacob. I'd like you, if you have your Bibles, to turn to Genesis 25. Genesis 25, and we're going to begin with verse 19. This is the account of Abraham's son Isaac. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean from Paddan Aram, and sister of Laban the Aramean. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her, and she said, "Why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger." Now, when the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red. His whole body was like a hairy garment, so they named him Esau. After this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel, so he was named Jacob. Now, Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. Okay. So from the beginning, we learn about Jacob, the heel holder, the heel. From the word to hold the heel or to grasp the heel. And literally, that's what he came out of the womb doing. The meaning, as we shall find out later, not only was it literal, but it became very symbolic and spiritual as well, because he was the supplanter. He was the one to grasp the heel, to trip you up, and to trip you up by means of deceit. By contrast, Esau came forth red, it says, and hairy, and his descendants became known as the Edomites, which is the word for red, which is closely related to the word Adam, Edom, Adam. Adam, they're the first one to come forth from God's hand, really named, was another word for red. So Esau was this hairy, reddish baby. Jacob was this one who tripped him up, grasped his heel. So the Bible goes on then to describe the differences between these two sons. As they grew up, Esau became an outdoorsman. If he lived today, I kind of like to think of Esau as being the host of a hunting and fishing program on television. Big, burly guy. Beard. Lumberjack kind of a feel to him. Loves to go out in the outdoors, the woods, the hills, the mountains, the valleys, to hunt, to trap game. Physically strong, loving the thrill of adventure, the daring of the hunt. Jacob, on the other hand, was a homebody, perhaps quieter, preferring to stay close at home, preferring the domestic life instead of the roving, unsettled one. The differences ran much deeper than that, however. Their differences were later illustrated by the way they looked at life, and the way they looked particularly at the covenant promises and the blessings that belonged to the descendants of Abraham, their grandfather. Esau, as you read it here, is described as a man who lived for the present. Esau is described as an individual who basically saw what was right in front of his nose. And he experienced life just whatever came, came. Living for the present, not giving much thought, much attention to the future at all. He was a naturalist, materialist. He thought life was for the enjoying and the gratifying. I imagine Esau, if you got to know him, would have been kind of like the life of the party. You know, fascinating everyone with his tales and his stories, joking around, probably being able to give you this gigantic belly laugh when he told something particularly funny, and people would have loved to be around him. But But as for spiritual things, didn't seem to care much for that. Didn't seem to give it much thought. Now Jacob, on the other hand, seemed to have a taste for the spiritual world. At least he had much more of a taste than Esau, his brother, did. He seemed to sense that the birthright and the blessing promised to the firstborn was somehow connected with God and the future. Jacob was an individual who, instead of looking always at what was right in front of him, he thought about what was to come. He thought about what the future would be like, what it might bring, and he sensed that this birthright and this covenant that this God of his grandfather Abraham had made was of supreme importance. And so we come to the story where Jacob convinced his brother Esau to sell that birthright. Now, Esau, of course, came forth from the womb first, so he was technically the firstborn. The birthright was his. And I imagine that as Esau grew up, he had been reminded by his father Isaac and perhaps his mother Rebecca, the birthright's yours, son. You're the head of the family. You're the one that will be the leader. Esau knew this. But as the story goes on, we come to it, we remember the story. Esau, out on one of his hunts, one of his escapades, exhausted, tired, and extremely hungry, starving from being out on the hunt, he begged Jacob as he neared home, he begged Jacob for some of the stew that he had been cooking. Now, I don't know how long Jacob must have thought about this, or whether or not it just came to him in one quick flash of insight. But Jacob decided to offer that stew. And I've always wondered why Esau didn't just take it. But he didn't. He asked Jacob, and he needed Jacob to be willing to give it to him. So Jacob offered that stew to Esau on one condition, that Esau give up his birthright privileges for that stew. And so in what has to be one of the most incredible examples of a lack of foresight, Esau makes that trade. Talk about seeing what was right in front of your nose only. Just right there, I'm going to trade the birthright for this momentary satisfaction of my appetite. And a bowl of stew now, right now, in exchange for the relinquishment of the whole future as head of the family, both physically and spiritually. And I think it was the spiritual thing that bothered Esau. But you can understand his thinking. I'm not sure I want to be the leader and all that might entail and all the responsibilities that it brings along. I just want to go out and hunt. I just want to go out and be free. I want to be able to do what I want to do when I want to do it. The Bible says that Esau despised his birthright. Those are the words that are used. He despised his birthright because he had no real interest in spiritual things. He didn't value the covenant blessings, the divine connection which it would have been his to enjoy. As a matter of fact, probably Esau was relieved that responsibility had now been removed from him. Oh, later on, he seemed to repent when he realized everything that he had given away on that day. But I'm not sure he ever regretted the spiritual connotations of what he relinquished. He never valued them to begin with. In Hebrews, the 12th chapter, verses 16 and 17, we read that Esau was a profane man. Now, that doesn't mean that he cussed a lot. He may have. But it means more that he lightly esteemed the spiritual leadership and privileges that came with being the firstborn. In short, Esau was a godless man. Not a mean man necessarily, not necessarily a violent man or an especially sinful man, but a godless man. A man who had little or no use for God. There are godless men and women today. Oh, they're not bad people. As you look at their lives and so forth, they might be very disciplined. They might be very orderly. They might be polite. They might be courteous. They may even help their neighbor. But they're godless because they have no use nor interest for God in their lives. Now, Jacob, on the other hand, was not an especially good man. He wasn't an especially upright man. He was a man who had real serious character flaws. If you could have put Esau and Jacob in the same room, I'm thinking that there's a good chance you would have preferred perhaps the company of Esau, the life of the party, over the brooding and the quiet Jacob. But Jacob did value the covenant. Jacob valued the covenant. Don't forget that. He did have an estimation and an appreciation of spiritual things. In the book Patriarchs and Prophets, page 178, we read this about Jacob. With secret longing, he listened to all his father told concerning the spiritual birthright. He carefully treasured what he had learned from his mother. Day and night, the subject occupied his thoughts until it became the absorbing interest of his life. In short, whatever faults Jacob had, God could work with him because he was interested in spiritual things. Esau simply gave God no room to work or influence. I want to focus today on Jacob's journey, a journey that lasted at least 40 years, a spiritual life journey that began early and ended at the river Jabbok, where the heel finally had his name changed to Israel, the one who wrestled with God and overcame. His life is a lesson to all of us about the difficulty at times and the sojourn it takes before we finally find God. It's also a lesson, of course, of God's amazing grace and the way that he patiently works with us in leading us to our own river Jabbok and our own place Penuel. Have you ever tried to trace the thread and the theme of deception? Remember, Jacob was the heel holder, the one who would trip you up by means of deception. Have you ever traced the theme of deception in the family of Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, and Esau and their extended family? It's astounding. It starts with Jacob taking the birthright from Esau by deception, and then moves to Isaac, concealing the giving of the blessing from both Rebekah and Jacob. Then Rebekah and Jacob, who deceive Isaac in the giving of the blessing. It moves on to Isaac and Rebekah hiding their true relationship with Abimelech. From there, we go to Laban deceiving Jacob with Leah instead of Rachel. Then Laban deceives Jacob by taking all the spotted goats and hiding them from him, while Jacob in turn deceives Laban by mating only the stronger animals and giving the weaker ones back to Laban. Jacob then leaves Laban secretly, and Rachel steals her father's idols and then lies to him about them. We go on to Jacob's sons, deceiving the men of Shechem who wanted to intermarry with them. Then the lie that the brothers told their father Jacob about Joseph being eaten by wild animals. And let's not forget the deception Judah pulled on his wife Tamar, and the way Tamar deceived Judah by the road. I challenge you to read the entire story and write down every time there's a lie being told or somebody is being deceived or having the wool pulled over their eyes. You will be amazed. And yet, through this incredible maze of deception and lying, God is present through it all. He does not turn away. He does not abandon them in search of some other family that will better cooperate with him. God remains present. But the story of Jacob shows us that though God remains present, and though his grace and his mercy is available at all times, we do experience the consequences of our choices, don't we? Our lives are full of choices. We make them every day. Some choices are made in an instant, and we live with the consequences for the rest of our lives. An unplanned pregnancy, a first drink, a dishonest exam. They're made, all of them, in a moment, but they don't end there. In the movie The Natural, Robert Redford plays a baseball player who's blessed with enormous talent. He can hit the ball a mile, and he had a pitching arm that was incredible. A farm boy from the Midwest. He got involved with a disturbed woman who shot him, leaving a bullet in his stomach. The next 16 years, it says, he drifted from town to town till finally, in his later years, he decided to give baseball one last try, only to find that the bullet, still lodged in his stomach, would not let him play. And he utters some famous words in the movie where he says, "Some mistakes you never stop paying for." And that's the way it is with life, isn't it? It's also the way it was in Jacob's life. Consequences dogged him for the rest of his life. But we need to remember that in the midst of living those consequences, however painful they might be, God is still with us in the midst of those consequences, alongside those consequences, in spite of those consequences. Don't look at the consequences as something that should separate you from God. Young people, a choice of a moment, listen to this, a choice of a moment can mean the pain and loss of a lifetime. So choose wisely, carefully, and always with your Heavenly Father in mind. In Jacob's case, it was a series of choices, from the deception and stealing the birthright to his marriage to two sisters. They all affected him as long as he lived. But I want to hasten on now to the river, Jabbok. That's where we want to go right now, for that was when and where Jacob became Israel. You know the story. The experience was occasioned by the fear and the dread that Jacob had of meeting his brother Esau again. For he had been gone for over 20 years. He had not forgotten what Jacob swore that he would do to him. It was his mother that told him. Rebekah told Jacob, "You got to leave because Esau will become, something's going to happen to you if you stay." And that was another example. Rebekah, in a moment, made the decision to deceive Isaac so that Jacob would get the blessing. And it cost her her son. She never saw him again. So here he is, years later. He has been informed that Esau is coming with 400 men, armed. Jacob fears the worst. Who wouldn't? His sin was coming back to haunt him. Some mistakes you never stop paying for, he must have thought. It is at this point that Jacob made a choice, an important choice, one that's sometimes overlooked. He split his family and his possessions into two camps. And then he went off to be alone. Alone with his thoughts, alone with the memories of his sins, but also the memories of God's past presence and promises. And it was there that he grappled and he struggled with an unknown assailant all night long. At some point, probably when his hip was injured, he realized that he was wrestling not with a mere man, but with none other but God. If you look at Genesis 32, and begin with verse 24, we read, "So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, 'Let me go, for it is daybreak.' But Jacob replied, 'I will not let you go until you bless me, or unless you bless me.' The man asked him, 'What is your name?' 'Jacob,' he answered. Then the man said, 'Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome.'" What are we to make of this particular passage here? It starts out as a wrestling match. Jacob's wrestling with someone that he's afraid of, someone that he is convinced is there to do him harm. But at some point, he recognizes that this individual is not there to do him harm. And so instead of trying to overcome him to protect himself, you get the picture that at the end, all Jacob was doing was wrapping his arms around his legs and refusing to let him go. Never seen a wrestling match like that, have you? Usually you're trying to pin the person. You're trying to overcome them, overpower them, causing them to give up. But we see the opposite here. Jacob now is holding on for dear life. "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The kind of blessing that Jacob craved comes not to the well-meaning, but to the desperate. Not to the man who is ascending, but to the man who is at the end of his tether. It comes to the person who's tried all other routes, perhaps, to happiness and achievement, only to find themselves still in misery and turmoil. It comes to the person who at last fully recognizes that only God can satisfy him, and he finds himself reaching out to him as a drowning man clutches at a straw. It comes to the man who admits that God ought not to accept him or her, and yet refuse to take no for an answer, even from God. It wasn't merely deliverance at this point from Esau that Jacob craved. If that were the case, God would have overcome Jacob. But instead, it was God himself that Jacob craved as daybreak approached. It was God himself. It was to know him and to be completely surrendered to him that Jacob finally desired more than anything else. Nothing else mattered. When we want God to be all that we need, then we will, in effect, have our names changed, because we'll be different people. The old Scottish preacher, A.B. Davidson, as he was commenting on this experience in his commentary, said, "Where are you on your journey today? Have you been to Jabbok yet?" Jacob's story should disturb us and yet encourage us as well. It tells us that God will never leave us, but relentlessly push us forward to a full, complete relationship with him. This is not an easy road, but to truly know God and his blessing far outweighs anything we have to leave behind on the journey. Charles Wesley, the brother of John Wesley and that great hymn writer, captured Jacob's experience with the words to this hymn: "Yield to me now, for I am weak, but confident in self-despair. Speak to my heart, in blessing speak. Be conquered by my instant prayer." There is a sense in which we conquer God. There's a sense in which we conquer God by that self-surrender. For the angel, the heavenly being, said to Jacob, "You have struggled with God and have overcome." Charles Wesley knew that inner meaning, the sense in which we conquer God, be conquered by my instant prayer. Yes, it may seem strange to speak of conquering or overcoming God, but in Jacob's refusal to let go of God lays the secret of overcoming. The mighty God of the universe, the Creator God, will allow himself to be wrestled with. Indeed, when the time is right, he is the one who is our darkness, who in our darkness comes to us to wrestle with us out of our desire to have life on our own terms instead of God's. I like the way another commentary put it. Jacob held him, meaning God, more convulsively fast, as if aware that the daylight was likely to rob him of his anticipated blessing, in which there seems concealed a very deep truth. God is approached more nearly in that which is indefinite than in that which is definite and distinct. He is felt in awe and wonder and worship, rather than sometimes in clear conception. There's a sense in which darkness has more of God than even light has. In sorrow, haunted by uncertain presentiments, we feel the infinite around us. The gloom disperses, the world's joy comes again, and it seems as if God were gone. The being who had touched us with a withering hand and wrestled with us, yet whose presence, even when most terrible, was more blessed than his absence. Yet, yes, in solitary, silent, vague darkness, the awful one is near. As Adventists, we have long talked about the time of Jacob's trouble, haven't we? We've applied it to that great time of great tribulation just before Jesus returns. The plagues are being poured out. Probation is closed. There's a death decree for all who will not follow the revelation beast. But I think those who successfully stand in that day will do so because they have already been at the brook Jabbok. And they have named it Penuel, meaning the face of God. Now is the time, then, to seek God wholeheartedly, to plead for his blessing, to have our characters changed so we can have our names changed. Revelation 2:17 tells us that to him that overcomes, I will give him a white stone with a new name written on it, known only to him who receives it. We come into this world having no choice over the name that is given to us. We can go out of this world because we've chosen to let God give us a new name, because we've wrestled with Him and overcome.